Welcome to Syncreate. This is a show where we explore the intersections between creativity, psychology, and spirituality. We believe everyone has the capacity to be creative. Our goal is to demystify the creative process and expand the boundaries of what it means to be creative. I'm Melinda Rothaus, and I help individuals and organizations bring their creative dreams and visions to life. So my very special guest today is Dr. Stephen Pritzker. He's the co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Creativity, among many other things. He was also one of my mentors at Saybrook University, where he continues to teach and was for a long time the head of the Creativity Studies program there. And before that, he was a television writer and wrote for many different shows over the years, including the award-winning Mary Tyler Moore Show. So, Dr. Pritzker, very delighted to have you here today. And yes, you helped me get there. So thanks to you for that. Okay. So we were talking leading up to this, and kind of one of the themes that as we were sort of riffing on what we might talk about was this idea of the connection between creativity and synchronicity and how we can really kind of, begin to trust the intuitions and the synchronicities that arise and how they can sort of guide our creative process. So you've had this amazing career and you've done so many different things. And I'm curious, just kind of diving into that topic, you were telling me a little bit about how you even got to Hollywood in the first place. But, how has synchronicity played a role in your career and your own creativity?
Well, I'm not sure if it's luck or synchronicity.
Right.
The research on synchronicity is hard. It's almost like religion. You almost have to have faith in it and believe in it because you can't. It doesn't seem to. The part that throws me is I'll say, okay, I ran into this person in some obscure place, and they'll say, yeah, but if you compute the odds and the thing, it's not as rare as you think it is. And I say, well, I'm going to stay with my. I think it's a rare thing and go with that.
Seemed pretty cool to me, right? Yeah.
Worked for me.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like TV. I had a business degree and I didn't study writing at all in college. And I was working in the Dick Van Dyke Show came on, which was about TV writers. And it just, I'd never thought about TV writing. I thought, well, that looks like fun. And I've always been kind of a class clown and a little funny. So maybe I can do that. But it also helped that my mother had two friends and another acquaintance that all had gone to Hollywood and become successful comedy writers in New York and then Hollywood. So I had someone. When I got the idea, I had someone to send the script to, and half a script. I couldn't even do a whole script.
Right.
And who could tell me, I just said, tell me, you think I can do this or not? And he said, yeah. And then he was a producer of the Andy Griffith Show. And he never gave me an assignment, which I would have really appreciated, but he did give me the confidence, and he told an agent about me, and that never led to anything directly. But the coincidence or synchronicity or whatever you want to call it was that my mother had this, these friends, and so I had a model in my head. You go to Hollywood and you just do it,
Right.
It wasn't like. When I got there, I realized there's like thousands of people there trying to do the same thing I am. And that was a little bit discouraging.
But I love that it just, it was a possibility for you. It opened up a possibility in your mind, like this is a thing that people do and it can be done.
Yeah, and it didn't hurt that I had been working for a company for a couple of years in the food industry, and I wanted to be in advertising, and I couldn't get an agency. Jobs were really hard. And I got one at a client, and I really saw what advertising was, mm-hmm. and I had the glamorous Mad Men vision. And it turned, Mad Men actually was probably a closer thing. I never worked for an agency, but I just saw a guy who was a model of who I wanted to be, who got canned, you know.
Right.
For reasons that I couldn't find clearly, other than he did something somebody didn't like. So it just kind of knocked the glamour or the vision of what advertising is and what it could be out of my head. And so I felt doing TV that was I could be proud of would be a better thing. Now, it didn't make sense in a lot of ways. And some of these decisions never do.
Right.
They have to be done on some kind of gut feeling.
Yes.
And tens of thousands of people have them, and a lot of them don't work out. But I applaud each person that followed it. And I don't think I've never talked to anyone who regretted it because they took a shot at something they wanted.
Yes.
And that in itself is an accomplishment of sorts.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you got to show up, right? In order for something to happen.
Go. Yeah. You know, it won't happen just, you know, out of the blue. There are occasions, I guess, with actors that have been, you know, discovered
on
or whatever.
The street
that,
or
but you don't know the truth. You don't know the truth of those stories. One thing I found out about Hollywood is it is all a myth.
Yes.
It's a beautiful lie we all want to believe.
Yes. But so how did you land your first break, your first TV writing gig?
And again, you know, I have to say it was through a friend of my mother's in Chicago who had a nephew who worked at William Morris. And I had another agent before that. But when I got a chance, William Morris used to be the biggest agency. And that's who you wanted to be with, theoretically. And he was a junior agent there, but he liked my stuff. And he sent it to somebody who had done a show called Laugh-In, which was number one at the time. Mm-hmm. And this guy really liked my stuff. Now, this wasn't the kind of writing I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I wanted to do sitcoms about people. These were jokes, and I just wrote them. And so, how random is that? And then he ended up loving them and hiring me and doing a lot of – I did some shows with him because I just landed a job. I was almost out of money. I mean, I was really, really – and I had gotten a job. You know, at a hardware. I was going to do the advertising marketing at a hardware. They made door knobs. I mean, there couldn't be anything more depressing. They were very pretty door knobs.
Well, I'm sure.
Beauty could only carry stuff so far. And my office, right off the factory where they were making these doors, I'd open the door and I'd go, it was like, in the city of industry, it was like my nightmare.
Yeah.
And then this came along, and after 3 weeks, the guy who hired me was so nice. And I said, you know, I went through a whole hiring process. He took me out to dinner, and you gave me a good salary compared to what I was making. And I got this offer, and he said, no, you got to take it, go. And so, you know, you run across people, you go, God, that guy was nice.
Yeah.
And more. So this guy was named Digby Wolf, and he was a head writer on Laugh-In. So he had a spinoff that he was going to do. So a spinoff of the number one show, you're thinking, this is may not be what I want to do, but it's going to get me some.
Right.
So we did some specials. He had some specials. So the first show I had my name on was a Tennessee Ernie Ford special. But the guests were like Jack Benny, Lucille Ball, Andy Griffith.
Amazing.
So I was like, I was just behind stage looking at these people going, yeah. Oh my God, this is awesome. It doesn't matter that, you know, what it was. So we did a couple, we did a pilot, and we did this show. And it was produced by George Schlatter, who didn't laugh in. And the whole idea was life is speeding up. Mm-hmm. This is in the late 60s, around 1970 or something, a long, long time.
And it can just continues to speed up.
Yeah. But the idea was of quick clips and the staff, the writing staff that Digby had hired, had some amazing, amazing people on it. People went on to do All in the Family, and Albert Brooks was, he was like 19 or something. We were, there were, you know, it was great, great people, a guy that went on, many of them went on to very successful careers. So we had all done this writing, and then we got the first show, and the first show was, we hated it, and the staff, and we spoke up. They said, you speak up. I'm
you be the one.
Like the youngest next to Albert. And I'm like, well, you know, because this was only 3 years after I got to Hollywood.
Yeah.
With no experience. And a year I burned. So I'm like, well, geez, I don't know. All right, okay. I'll just say what we feel.
Yeah.
We hate the show.
How'd that go over?
I said, well, that's the show.
Yeah.
You know. It was very political. I was very, very liberal, and to the extent that we didn't feel it was pop television anymore. It was more preaching kind of thing. So it went on the air, and it was the biggest bomb that ever hit the air.
Oh no.
The biggest bomb within it was canceled by Tuesday. I swear to you, the whole show, we had already shot 7 or 8, and it was canceled. Oh, we had better shows. We gave you better material.
Yeah.
Why didn't you?
Right.
Well, that material is, you know, gone, and people didn't like the concept. It was probably seemed slow now or not that fast, but for the time it was very fast, but they hated the political stuff and they were calling up, and I'm driving home on Sunday from a thing, and one of the guys was on the radio, one of the writers was on the radio, and he said, you know, I'm on this show and it got canceled. I'm going,
oh no,
back to square one. Only worse. I mean, I got the worst credit anybody ever had. At that time, I think it was the first show that had been canceled after one episode. So it
really
had,
wow, that's a dubious distinction.
It is. It's dubious Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah. So
that would be a good Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I like that one.
Exactly.
So I'm broke. I've got a terrible credit. And I didn't know what I was gonna do. And something happened with my folks that was terrible. And I had to send him what money I had. So I'm down to, like, I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent. And William Morris, the guy William Morris called, and he said, they're having a, you can go to that girl and get a, if they like you, they'll let you write a script. You'll get minimum. You won't get what normal writers get, but it's a deal with the Writers Guild. So they want to give that to someone. So go over there and see if you can get that. So I went over there. I was so nervous because, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be on the street in a month. And I got lucky because a guy there in the room really either related to me in some way, saw himself in me, and he said, "Don't worry, you got it." And I did the script, and the guys that produced it, they told me, "You have to do it in a week. You turn it in 2 weeks." And there was no hurry. I mean, it was spring.
Yeah.
They were just doing that. I don't know why they did it, but it taught me to write quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I better write quickly.
Nothing like a deadline.
And actually, living, you have to write pretty quickly at that. So they liked the script. It was a story they had come up with, and they liked it. And they gave it to Marlo Thomas, who was the star of the show, and she hated it.
Oh, so no. I went, "Oh, no. Here we go again."
Not going well. But they did something really, really kind. These guys, Sal Turtledove and Bernie Orenstein, they sent it to two people to read. And one of them were guys doing a show called Room 222, which was a high school show that was very good. And I wanted to work on that show. And they liked it. And I went over there. I met Jim Brooks, who became Jim Brooks, you know. And Alan Burns, I think, was there at the time, and Gene Reynolds. And they said, "Fine, do a script." And I went out and did research. And the other guy was Ed Weinberger, who was doing Cosby. And I gave him a story. And he said, "We're not going to do that story. So I liked your story, but we're not going to do it." But at Room 222, I went and did research with Gene Reynolds at a high school and did a show about somebody who wanted to be a teacher and how difficult it really is to control a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really teach you that in,
exactly.
in college. So I liked it, and they liked it. And this is like a Hollywood thing. You talk about, I don't know if it's synchronicity or dumb luck. I think, you know, also a lot of it is dumb luck.
Yeah.
Because who can design this? The story editor was leaving, even though the show was picked up, because he wanted to write movies. He had a chance. And they said, "We'd like you to be the story editor." Now, I hadn't even had a show on the air yet.
Right.
My show went on the air. I got credit as my own story editor. I don't know if anybody's ever had that happen.
That's amazing.
And the show, the ratings went up in the spring, and the show got an Emmy for Best New Comedy Series. And then I left after that year. The other guy came back. It was a temporary position, but... Jim Brooks and Alan Burns did the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And so I went over to them. They liked the work I'd done. And so I got to work there. And everybody liked the work on Room 222. So I was getting all kinds of offers as far as doing script writing. And so that then established my career.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if that... probably more information than you wanted, but that, but I tell that because I feel there's a series of really lucky things that happened there.
Sure.
That occurred because I followed through on them. I did what they're. I can give you also a series of mistakes.
You know, I just think it's interesting, like you were kind of saying, you know, the mistakes along the way, right? I mean, it's not, yeah. It's not a linear path, right? We have false starts, no. And we have things that don't work. And then we, you know, if we keep showing up, eventually something happens and one
maybe.
Thing leads to
maybe.
Another.
That, yeah, but that's the thing. It's maybe.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that doesn't. But I never met anyone, Bob. I don't know if I've ever really asked that question. You know, do you really wish you hadn't done this?
Right.
Do you wish you hadn't tried for something you didn't get? It'd
right.
be an interesting.
Well, it's interesting.
An interesting research.
Yeah. They've done question. Studies at the end of life, and the biggest regret that most people have is what they didn't do.
Exactly. That came to mind too. The things you don't do.
Yeah.
You don't trying for things that you don't get. That's a good thing, you know.
Yeah.
At least you didn't, you know, say, well, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
And people do regret that. And that's part of what interested me in eventually when I transitioned to creativity is, you know, that I feel that with all of the pain and, you know, suffering that goes with the entertainment business, and there's plenty of that, I got something from the experience I couldn't get, I couldn't put a price on in terms of understanding more about life, entertaining people, enlightening in some cases myself and other people. You know, so the good was so good that you say, well, the stuff that didn't work, it's a privilege to have been a part of something that reached
so many people.
More everybody in America.
Exactly. Yeah. And I recently watched that documentary that came out about her and about the show. Oh, yeah. And I'm curious, just what was it like to be in that environment and to work on that show?
Well, that documentary, I presented the feminine side of there weren't a lot of women involved when I was there.
Right. Yeah.
There were, they did write 20, whatever number of percent of the scripts was higher than any other show.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, women were not there that much. It was easy. And I turned down a staff position on that show. That's one of the regrets I had.
How come?
Things. Because I had the experience on Room 222 was terrible.
Mm.
I mean, they left to do Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah.
I was in alone with no experience writing for a national audience.
Yeah.
I was, you know, frankly, I didn't like it. I didn't think it was the way to work, even though, shows do that. Mm-hmm. All in the Family, Norman Lear, he tore up the show every week. And that wasn't my way of working. It was too, I'm getting my stomach's turning just from talking about it.
Oh, gosh.
I thought I might be in that position again as the only, there weren't big staffs then. There wasn't even a lawyer in the first year. So I thought, I'm going to be in that room and I'm going to be miserable trying to do this stuff and it's not going to work for me.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it was a logical decision.
Yeah. You know, you made the decision based on the information you had at the time, right? And eventually pivoted to academia. So how did you decide to make that shift into then studying creativity?
Well, we're going to do a dissolve.
Okay.
Because this is like 25 years later. It wasn't like, oh, I'm not going to be a story. I'll go work in academia.
So you kind of worked through your whole TV
career.
I
played it out in show business for, I think it was 20, 22, 23 years at least.
Yeah.
That I was doing it. So you age out in that business, most people. And I was the oldest person in the room there for the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So at that point, you know, you're kind of, it's clear you're not going to be the oldest person in the room into your 50s.
Right.
So I had gone to around 50, and it wasn't instantaneous. It was a slow process in which I didn't know what I was going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't want to just take what I had and go try to live the rest of my life on that. I wanted another challenge or another thing that interested me. And I started teaching at UCLA Extension almost immediately. So teaching did crop up as something I was doing.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. And I didn't want to just teach writing, though. I didn't feel that was what I wanted to do. And the term creativity popped up in a class I was taking at UCLA. If you teach, you can take free class. So I was taking these random classes.
Yeah.
And I thought about consulting on things like that. But because I had been a business major, mm-hmm. but it didn't ring any more appealing to me. Ultimately, I got stationery printed. I didn't want to sell it. I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And so, I did a couple of seminars for big business companies that mm-hmm. paid well.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think the people that worked there really wanted that. They were, salesmen who wanted to be out selling. And they didn't have any interest in listening to anybody. Well, I didn't take it personally. It's just they didn't want it. They weren't in the market for that. They mm-hmm. didn't feel they needed it. They thought they were already the most creative people in the world.
Right.
The term creativity came up, and I didn't know anything about it. So I had... Something I didn't mention, though, was in the middle of my career when I could see that I wasn't going to want to do this or sustain this for a longer time.
Yeah.
I stopped and got a master's degree in psychology.
Okay.
So I had that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to maybe be a therapist or, mm-hmm. Work with writers. But then when it came to the time, even though I could have done it, I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So following the idea that I shouldn't do anything I don't want to do. I was really spoiled brat at this point.
But you were also following your intuition. I had to work on
a television show. To finance my PhD, I'd worked on a television show I didn't like. So I thought, I'm going to try something I really... I'm excited about. And so when creativity popped up, I went to look at the research, and I found that it was like a curve that went up and down the amount of by decade. It went up and went down and went up, went down. And when I looked in the early 90s, it had gone down. So I thought, well, maybe it'll go up.
Yeah.
I'll follow a pattern. I see a pattern here.
Yeah.
And I looked into it, and I liked some of the stuff I read.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized it was kind of a niche thing over, it wasn't a big, but there was a division of APA, and there was a journal, and there were, it was a thing. It wasn't a huge thing, but it was something that I was excited about learning more about
mm-hmm.
and being a part of. So I turned out one of the guys that was teaching at USC, Dennis Hosevar, had done some work in creativity. So I got my master's at USC. So I went down and talked to him, and he was, you can do this. And
there a particular aspect of creativity that intrigued you? I mean, having been a television writer, or like what kind of drew you to the field?
I mean, I thought, well, ultimately that wasn't what I went in for, but ultimately my dissertation was on television situation comedy writing.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very interesting. A lot of people would look at it, and nobody is, few people looked at it.
Right. Nobody took your advice.
Well, it was about the shooting of one episode of comedy. So I guess it was pretty specific mm-hmm. and, But I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. I thought I'd probably want to teach if I could, mm-hmm. but I realized that I was, you know, not in the typical person that gets a teaching job
right.
at university. And that's what I wanted, especially when I started doing research.
So how did you find your way there?
Well, again, synchronicity, luck, whatever you want to call it. Dennis Hocevar knew Mark Runkle, who was at Fullerton at that point, and he said he has something every month or something. Why don't you get in touch? So I went down there, and Mark had this little group of people that just met to talk about creativity, and he was interested in the fact I was a writer in my history. And so I had an idea about my second year in or third year based on my doing research at USC. I had gone to different libraries to get books on mm-hmm. creativity. I was in the School of Education. My degree was in educational psychology. Mm-hmm. But in order to find some stuff, I had to go over to the engineering library.
Right.
Law library. And I was like, this is crazy because it's a field, but it isn't. I mean, it's scattered
right.
all over. Should be centralized. So I had this idea for Encyclopedia of Creativity. And I originally thought it would be for the public. And I went over and talked to Mark about it and had lunch with him. And he said, yeah, that's good. You know, so now I had a guy who was the most published guy
yeah, in the field.
My co-writer. I mean, you know, look at the synchronicity with that.
Exactly.
That's crazy, right?
Someone knows someone, you get talking, yeah. All of a sudden there's an encyclopedia of creativity.
Yeah. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just, okay, we went to a publisher. We did get an agent. And he tried to sell it to the public
mm-hmm.
and to a publisher,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't buy it. And Mark and I were talking, and he said, "Well, what if we tried to do it as a, you know, a research for, you know, for people in education and business and stuff?" And I said, "Well, let's give it a shot. Nothing's happening with this." Boom, we got two offers. He sent two people, two academic press in the Southern, and we were able to get a pretty good deal for educational publication.
Yeah.
And it, you know, got published. It got great reviews. It got published about the time I got my PhD. So,
nice
you know,
work.
I just barely got a PhD on that. I had stuff published. I'm trying to get students now. I'm still teaching the writing class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get them to, you know, think a little bit more aggressively about getting publication.
Yeah.
You find that somebody who can open the door for you. And if you're lucky, very lucky, they will do it. And, Mark didn't do it for me. He did it for himself because he thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
And but so you have to come in. You have to come in with something.
Yeah. Usually. But you had an idea, and he was open to it.
I didn't say, that'd be a nice thing to have.
Yeah.
Someday we will do it. I did it.
Yeah.
And that's really what I think is important. And look at you, you know, the stuff you're doing.
You and my other faculty at Saybrook really encouraged me to get out there and start publishing, turn my dissertation into a book. And I've taken that to heart, you know. But I was going to say, you know, in reference to your your teaching career, you know, when I was looking around at programs and I was interested in the psychology of creativity. And so Saybrook University has this somewhat unique program. And I remember when I was looking at the program and I spoke with you and I spoke with Ruth Richards, and also with Terry Goslin Jones. And she was an alum at the time. And, but I remember the conversation with you. It really struck me because I said, you know, here I am, like, I'm already out here in the work world. I'm doing coaching and I, you know, I have a career and all this, but I don't necessarily want to be a career academic. So what does one do with a degree in creativity studies, you know? And you said to me, you know, in the 21st century, we are going to need people who are experts in creativity, who understand creativity and how it can be used to address, you know, the complex problems of our time. And that really struck me, you know, and at the end of the day, that's the one program I ended up applying to, you know?
Yeah, it was very, I knew a little bit of what I envisioned it and why I had gone into it. That was very clear to me. And the bottom line is that it helps people. It's personal growth as well as accomplishment. That's a great combination.
Yes.
And I think that I was at a different stage in life at that point, and I had seen, you know, a lot, good and bad. And I wanted to kind of pass on what had happened to me and get the benefit of making this something special.
Yeah.
And Saybrook had popped up because it's like one thing leads to another. I had never heard of Saybrook.
Right. Neither had I.
Two people who were on the board of the encyclopedia were Stanley Krippner and Ruth Richard. So I said, well, they're both at the Saybrook.
What is
Saybrook?
This place?
I looked it up and I went to, again, I wasn't necessarily going to do this. A lot of this is synchronicity. There was I was in Austin, Texas, where you
I
are.
I am right now.
It's been a month and I thought about living there and, decided I wanted to live in the United States. Excuse me.
Yes. Understood.
Everything there in Texas, state of Texas, Texas, Texas. I said, if that radio, if that guy says Texas again, I'm going to smack the radio.
They're very proud.
Oh, yeah. Very proud in Texas. And the weather was a little hot. So I was going to go to Colorado. But I did my due diligence before. I love to ski I loved the mountains. But I went to the University of Denver where I had been a student briefly, and I talked to the Department of Psychology. I went to the University of Colorado. I talked to they were like, creativity, what English, please?
Right. English? What are you talking about?
We don't do that. Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, I can see that. You know,
right.
There's no creativity in this department.
Right.
So I had to go back to L.A. for a dental thing. My daughter was there, and I drove from Texas. I wasn't planning to do this at all. I was planning to go to Colorado and live there.
Yeah.
And ship stuff there. I went to L.A., and APA was in San Francisco. So I drove up to San Francisco. And a friend of mine had a sister who I knew, who was also a friend, who said, I'm going away for 2 weeks, so use my apartment. I mean, it's all laid out for me.
And there you were.
So I went to a Saybrook event, and I met Ruth. I called Ruth. And I said who I was and what I was, and I met Ruth, and Ruth is one of those people. Of course, you can do this. I said I want to walk across the Pacific Ocean. Of course you can. So she said, why don't you get in touch with Maureen O'Hare? I also met Dennis Jaffe, who are both guest speaking in my class.
Nice.
And I went to see Maureen O'Hare, who was the president at that point, who gave me an appointment, which is, again, lucky, you know. Mm-hmm. But I went in, and I just had the encyclopedia published, and I, you know, showed her a copy, and I said, I want to teach here because you're the place that gets creativity, because you got Ruth here.
Right.
And Ruth was really the doorkeeper in a way, because she was this creativity expert.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people would say, no, I don't want anyone else. You know, right. We don't need you. Well, I'm the...
Right.
Territorial. And she was open. Yeah, territorial. She was wide open to my coming in. And I talked about, well, maybe we could, you know, build a department, build a specialization, or, you know, some sort of a thing. And Maureen said, you can work part time. I'll give you the right now. I didn't go in an interview and do a lot what people do, you know.
Right. The official process? Of course not. Because you're not creative.
She just said, okay, go ahead. You start, and you work there. And about 3 months later, so I decided I'd live in San Francisco. I always liked it. It just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It was first on my list when I started saying I wanted to leave LA.
Yeah.
Then the tech thing came, and it's so expensive, and it didn't make sense. And But I just committed to live there then instantly.
And then you were. Yeah.
3 months later, somebody left the department at the time that Ruth and I were in. And Maureen said, I'm putting you on half time. You're going to chair that. So I'm brand new. I'm chairing it. And so then eventually it took years to get full time, though. It took 5 more years, I think.
Yeah.
But at least. But I got a part time job somewhere else. But you see, it seems like there's a lot of luck involved.
Of course. Right. Again, you know, it's like we can't necessarily foresee where the path is going to lead, particularly as creatives or people pursuing creative fields, you know. So then I think it becomes important to be able to sort of tap into that intuition and that, and trust that sense of synchronicity, right? That one conversation will lead to something. And yeah, and to go for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm mindful of our time. It's flown by. And unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up. But I'm curious. So you got to Saybrook, you're teaching, you build the creativity program. And I don't know, this might be a hard question, but over your years of teaching students and working with students around creativity, is there a particular piece of advice you would give, or what's the most important thing that you've come to understand about creativity and the creative process?
I think it's that not to categorize it.
Yeah.
To recognize that everyone's creativity is as unique as everyone is.
Yes.
And some people have the ability to stretch and grow. And I feel as a teacher, the only thing you do is give people the space to do that. And it's like as a parent, you can't, your kid will have to find their way.
Yes.
You know, you hopefully give them some things that are useful for them, and some understanding and some confidence. And then it's really up to the individual to find a way to do it. But and the ones that succeed tend to take chances and go ahead and do it. They don't sit there waiting for someone to knock on the door, because that, I don't have any story about I'm sitting there and someone came along.
Exactly.
And said, hey, you, you want to write a show? You want to be a professor? No, that doesn't happen. So taking charge of your life and being willing to go for what you want. I don't think it's wise to take. I don't think it's wise to take some of the risks I've done. I did an interview for a chapter about my career, and I came out and I thought, well, you know, I ended up saying at the end of it, don't do what I did. Because I mean, it could have been, you can see the spots where it could have been, right. You know, I would be on the street. I mean, it's been a little bit reckless. And because the first thing of just moving to Hollywood and doing that at, you know, 24, which is already getting toward that 30 age when you're too old.
Right. Yeah.
Theoretically. And don't follow those rules either, because, you know, who knows?
Right.
I didn't see too many people past 30 make it in, but.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And most creative people are not the ones who are following the rules usually. Right. So you do have to take risks, and sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't.
That's right. And that's both the good and bad part.
I mean, exactly.
You're in something where the personal stakes may be high, because if it works out, I've had now 25 years almost at Saybrook.
Yeah.
And I feel for a second career, there couldn't have been anything that made me happier.
Absolutely.
And it didn't have the downside of the job. There's, you know, stuff, but there's plenty of stuff. It's not
always teaching, everywhere.
Teaching isn't easy.
And
there's always stuff.
Of course.
As I look back, I'm happy. I had two careers that were very interesting, and I feel happy about the life I lived, and even, you know, I'm one that has gone over the mistakes, the could-haves, would-haves. I've got a PhD in that in my head.
Yes.
You know, I've got
exactly
35,000 hours necessary.
Right. Right.
And I could put the diploma on a wall. I can say, you know, with all of that, I don't regret any of it. I think it was really, I can't, some parts were fun, some parts were painful. All of it is living life. And that's what I think creativity, the most important thing about a creative life, you are engaged.
Yes.
You aren't sitting around. You are fully engaged in what you are doing.
Exactly.
And there's no substitute for that.
Mm-mm.
There's no, you are really living life at a pace, you know. I had that 2 years of that, going into the office and just hating every day. That is not what I think most people want out of life.
Indeed. I mean, there's nothing like working in an office to drive you into creativity. I had the same experience.
Yeah. I mean, part of the reason I didn't want to go to be a story editor, I did become a producer and I did go in years to shows, but, some of that was really fun and some of it wasn't, but,
sure. You
know, you sit in a room with a lot of really funny people and try to make jokes. And if it doesn't work, you've still got that time in that room.
Exactly. And, it's the right. It's the process as much as anything else. Yeah.
Process is great in terms of teaching you whether you want to learn or not.
Exactly.
It'll teach you something.
Exactly.
You can't disengage.
Right.
You're in life.
You're and there. I think
that, that is why I would like to see that. The next thing I'm really excited about doing is seeing that knowledge. Some of the knowledge that I was so excited about learning has since, in the last 25 years, worked its way into the general knowledge.
Absolutely. And creativity is out there. It's everywhere. It's a buzzword now, right? Yeah. Not so obscure. Yeah. So,
there's still, a lot of work to do, and getting it down into the educational system at the high school and grammar school and level. And there was just a bill passed in California that you can have to have they had cut the arts teachers, the education and arts teachers and arts and music.
Yeah.
And so
it's happening.
Somebody got a bill and they passed it, and the funding is in part of the bill to have this. Now that's going to make a huge difference in a lot of people's lives.
Of course.
You're talking about changing lives.
Yeah.
This is the core of what psychology is all about.
Yeah.
So as I see that and some of the other ways this is starting to influence the educational system, I think that that's really important, because if you can get into kids' heads that they can live a creative life, they can make their life creative,
and it opens up so much more possibility.
It can go in unexpected directions.
Absolutely.
Lots of options, lots of pitfalls, but you're fully engaged in life.
Yeah,
that's what a creative life is.
I love it. So I think that's a great note to end on. I'm so grateful to you for coming on this show today and for all of your mentorship over the years. And if people want to learn more about you or reach out to you, how can they find you, Steve?
Well, my email is easy. It's spritzker@saybrook.
Okay. And we'll put that in the show notes.
.edu.
Okay.
I don't have a website at this point. I should.
Old school.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not old school. I'm just busy. I'm working on another website.
Okay. There you go.
I haven't had time to do mine.
So. Okay. Fair enough. So thanks so much to Dr. Steven Pritzker for being with us today. And at SyncCreate, we're here to support your creative endeavors. So if you have an idea for a project or a new venture, please reach out to us for one-on-one coaching or join our SyncCreate 6-month coaching group starting in April. And if you say you heard about it here on the podcast, we're offering a 10% discount on that. You can find us at syncreate.org. We're on YouTube and all the podcast platforms, as well as social media. So find us and connect. And we are recording today at Record ATX Studios in Austin in collaboration with Mike Osborne at 14th Street Studios. And we've got Dr. Pritzker with us from California. Thanks again for being with us today, and we will see you next time.